This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Sunday Arts Magazine, David and Brendan with you. I'm the Brendan part.
And I'm the David part.
Yes, you are listening to Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy. And a big thank you to Katie for Three Calls and the Truth. She's filling in for a couple of weeks, is it?
I think 3 weeks because Andy's away at yet another sailing regatta. I think in Canada this time.
Ooh, yeah. Sounds good to me.
But he's not the sailor. His partner is. So.
I think it'd be more fun just to be sitting back.
And I think he sits on the deck and watches the boats as he's sipping a glass of Shardy or something.
Sounds perfect to me. Now, we can't go any further. I've got to get into it, David.
Yes.
David Bowie.
David Bowie. I'm a huge fan.
And I know you did an hour of your show, Driving You Mad, Driving You Crazy.
Yep.
Friday afternoons with the lovely Sue.
Of course.
Slightly unhinged Sue, but lovely all the same. No, we love her. So I got to go last night to a special fan event for David Bowie Is at Acme.
Right.
And I was actually doing it for work, but I got to enjoy it as well after the fact.
Now, this is part of Acme's Winter Masterpieces, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's their main event. So it is running all the way until November 1st. Mm. So
it's going to be huge for them.
It already has been.
Yeah. It's booked out well in advance, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And it's three cities of the world. You know, it started off at the Victorian Albert Museum in England.
Yes.
And was one of the biggest sellers in history there. And then went to New York, and here we are now with it.
Exactly. So how special is that Melbourne gets to be part of that history?
Yeah.
And you will be blown away, gobsmacked at some of the things that they have on show.
Yeah. Because it was more about the music with him, wasn't it? He, you know, it's all the theatrics, which is just the wonderful thing, and his different personas that he took on.
Yes, and when you sort of add all those up and all the history and the creativity attached to that, it's ridiculous. So you've got 50 legendary costumes, stage set designs, so a lot of his handwritten and hand-designed work, that his own sketches back in the day.
Wow.
And he just always had that creative mind, basically, always was thinking about his personas and who he was as an artist, which got a little bit stifled at the beginning of his career.
Yep.
And it really shows that he sort of broke through that, broke the mold and got to create his own career, basically.
Yeah, and it was really interesting because when he killed off Ziggy Stardust, huge outcry. People say, no, because it was just so loved. But it was stifling him, and he was becoming... and everyone else was obsessed with it, and he was leading this life almost, and thought, no, I've got to move on, and he totally turned a corner. And so that's why you've really got to admire him, is that he kept on reinventing himself.
Longevity. Exactly. And through costumes, through,
the style of music, which changed.
Because he was always a few years ahead of the game.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I love that it goes into all that. But it's not quite organised in a chronological order, and they sort of did that deliberately, so everyone comes at his creative output from a different perspective, which was really interesting. A little bit off-putting, because I didn't know a huge amount about Bowie going in, so I was kind of like, trying to find my way through. But what was beautiful was that the use of audio, so you have a headset going through, and at different points it just starts automatically playing things that may be playing on the screen or audio files that, interviews of his back in the day.
Right, okay.
And stuff. So it really is immersive, basically.
Yeah. And because everything was so well documented, he was part of, maybe not in the late 60s, early 70s, but pretty soon people were filming him on a regular basis, and so there was a lot of there would have been a lot of footage of, that they could have used from around the world, because everyone wanted to talk to Bowie. He was so dearly loved.
Exactly. And yeah. What's amazing is the first video footage that you get to see is his performance of Ziggy Stardust with the arm around the shoulder of another man.
Right, yeah.
That was groundbreaking for the time.
Well, and it was the 70s where they did all that, didn't they? And you know, who knew? Because everyone wore makeup on stage, and that was really quite interesting for a lot of gay performers like Freddie Mercury and Queen. The rest of the band never knew that he was gay because he always had a girlfriend because they were wearing makeup. They were wearing the outrageous outfits as Andrew Rhodes designed for them. So therefore, you know, it took them a while to work out, oh, hold on a minute. So in a way, people were out of the closet without actually having to declare that they were gay in those days.
Exactly, which we love. Well, we don't love that they had to hide, but yes. We love that they can be open these days, which is amazing. And he was definitely a trailblazer when it comes to that. He was always a little bit queer, you know, without actually
being
gay whatever. Anyway, so that's fabulous. Everyone should go check that out. But they're also doing a Bowie on Film retrospective, I guess you'd call it.
Because he's been in a few films,
hasn't he? He's been in a number of films and fairly high profile, but one of the probably most high profile ones was Labyrinth with Jennifer Connelly and directed by the amazing Jim Henson and his puppet creations, I guess you'd call it.
And it was probably just before he really became famous on that, the puppetry side, I think, wasn't it?
Well, it was 1986, so I think it was sort of full swing,
right,
actually.
Okay.
But it was produced by George Lucas, of all people. So it kind of had that backing behind it, which was great.
Yep.
It was, rewatching it, you know, I watched it a number of years ago, and rewatching the film, it is a little bit hokey in some parts, but gosh, it's charming. It is just one charming, sort of lovely film. And I don't know, it was really, really fun to go back and watch it. And there's sort of kids in the audience. So you get that new generation sort of discovering the old style. It was, you know, all practical effects.
And that's one of the most important things is I think that pop culture, it's so rich and so wonderful that it's a shame that a lot of younger people aren't, you know, looking backwards, because you always got to look back to move forward within the arts. And so it's good that something like this has come along.
Exactly. Now, this song is kind of perfect for that. It's called Changes.
Boom, boom. Yep.
And it is, you know, it's all about changing, reinvigorating and reteaching or teaching the new generation coming along. So you're listening to Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy 94.9. This is the one, the only David Bowie.
Joy 94.9.
You're on Joe 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine, and we did hear from David Bowie.
Great track.
So check out the exhibition. You've got a bit of time, but it is good to go around with people that are really excited to be there.
And yeah, and there are so many Bowie fans that I know, you know, that are just gagging to see this.
It is fabulous. Now, our first interview, David.
Yes.
I'm excited.
Oh, do you want me? You're going to do the intro?
I'll do the intro. Yes. I was just saying how excited I am.
Oh, you're excited.
About it.
Oh, I reckon. Are you sure? Excited about these
they
two.
They seem like lovely lads. We've got.
They were picking on you before. They said you had stayed out all night last night.
I'm pretty sure you were the one picking on me, David Hunt, you cheeky little thing. Now, we do have director Matthew Lutton and writer Declan Green. Thank you for coming in to Joy today.
Thanks for having us.
Now, we always like to hear a little bit about who you are, because you know, like how you got this far. So, Matt, let's start with you. You're directing this play that's going to be on at the Malt House. You're heavily involved in the Malt House.
Yes, I've just taken on the artistic director job as well. So
that's very, and you're very young to have this role.
Thank you. So, yeah, I've been an associate director there for the last 3 years, under Marion Potts, the previous artistic director, and I guess the interviews went well recently with the board, so I've been really lucky to step up and take on the head job.
So what's your background?
So I'm a theatre director. I trained in Perth and had a small company over there. I've been making theatre there for about 10 years. And then I moved over to Melbourne to join the Malt House in 2012.
Right. And so this is the only real job you've had, and you've just walked
up the ladder. I've actually been really lucky, or maybe this is really strange. I've all I only really directed theatre. That's sort of what I've been doing.
Wow.
For 12 years.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And Declan, give us a bit of an idea of you. You've written this play that we're going to be talking about a little bit later. So as a playwright, it's a pretty tough world, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely can be. I started out doing... I didn't train at all. I'm self-taught,
I guess. Right, okay. But, so you didn't learn script writing or...
No, I went to uni and I studied... I did a Bachelor of Arts, but I was majoring in art history. And then I started a little queer theatre company with my friend Ash Flanders called Sisters Grimm. And we do kind of weird, draggy, experimental queer theatre.
Right.
And I guess weirdly through that, I've sort of... that's how I developed my craft, and I've ended up establishing a solo kind of playwriting practice out of that. And this is, I think, maybe my fifth play I've kind of written, and my third play I've done at the Malthouse.
Right. Yep. And this was specially written for Malthouse. That's right, Matt, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Malthouse often will sort of be developing a play based on a concept or based on a pitch. And so Declan had written a piece called Pompeii LA a few years ago at the Malthouse that I directed as well. And Declan came in with this, you know, crazy monumental idea, and we all jumped on and said we want to do it. So Declan sort of, yeah, it was a pitch that we backed.
Right. Now, Declan, considering you haven't had any real experience as a playwright, apart from the stuff you've done, you know, this is a pretty big deal, isn't it, for you to now be working so closely with Malthouse?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, the first play I wrote for Malthouse was in 2010, and that was called Moth. And since then, I've worked at like STC and MTC and stuff like that. So it's not kind of necessarily like a new experience writing for the theatre or writing for a theatre company like the Malthouse, but in terms of the scope of this show, it's probably the hugest thing or most ambitious thing I've kind of tried to take on as a writer. Right. So it's been really good to have the support of Malthouse and the support of Matt as well to kind of bounce ideas off and kind of pull the script apart with me and go, in what way is this working and in what way is this not?
Yeah. So what's the name of the play?
The play's called I'm a Miracle.
Right. And was considering you wrote it, give us in 15 words or less,
I definitely can't do it in 15 words. If you ask anybody but the playwright if you want to describe succinctly. The play was initially a response to a miscarriage of justice that occurred in Texas in 2012, where a man named Marvin Lee Wilson, who is intellectually disabled, was executed on death row. And his final words were, in part, I'm a miracle. So I guess the project...
Well, why did he say that? Me being curious, why did he say I'm a miracle?
Well, I think that's actually one of the things that we were really curious about as well, because it's completely unknowable. Those were his last words and he didn't live to explain them at
all. Okay.
But he was deeply Christian at the end of his life, and it was quite a long statement that he made at the end, but I'm a miracle was a section of it. That in full it went, take me home, Jesus, take me home, Lord, I ain't left yet, must be a miracle, I'm a miracle. Those were in part his final words. And when I kind of read those, I thought there was something incredibly moving and something that was sad but also kind of remarkable in the idea of this African-American man who had lived with tremendous poverty and had been beaten down for his whole life, had done something terribly, terribly wrong. He'd executed a police informant or killed a police informant.
Wow.
Then had spent 18 years on death row kind of protesting that because his IQ was below 70, which is the legal point at which somebody should not be eligible to be executed in the state of Texas, essentially trying to be ameliorated or kind of let off for that, or to just have life in prison, I guess. But through a series of kind of legal maneuvers, the state of Texas were able to still see him strapped to that gurney and given a lethal injection.
Okay.
So from that point, I kind of decided early on that I wasn't actually going to be writing something that was directly biographically about the life of Marvin Lee Wilson. And instead, I've written three stories which respond to his life and respond to the idea of a miscarriage of justice. And I guess the idea that there are certain people in our society who fall below or outside of the protection of the law in a way that's sometimes conditioned by race, gender, sexuality. That there are some people who are recognised as less human or unprotected.
And are there three different stories that run separately or do they intertwine?
It must
be hard for you, the director here and the writer here.
Let Declan speak. Let him speak.
They run separately. There's the first, after a prologue, the first story you see is about, it's set in the 18th century slave colony of Suriname, and it's about a young Dutch soldier who's sent on a suicide mission kind of downriver to fight escaped slaves. In the second act, it's a kind of a domestic situation set in Melbourne in the present, and which is about a relationship that slowly deteriorates because one of the people in the relationship has dementia. And then the third story is this kind of epic fantasia or kind of fantasy about an angel destroying the law and destroying the history of colonialism, really, in an effort to rewrite the future.
So,
Just small ideas.
And what fascinates me now is, where did you get the domestic violence one, which are interesting with it, somebody that's struggling with their own self anyway, yep, and involved in domestic violence, which is so topical right this very moment. Yeah, yeah. But the other two, where did you find them?
The first story is actually was based on a book I read called Stedman's Suriname, which is actually it's a true story. It's actually about an 18th century Dutch army colonel,
right,
who was sent to the colony of Suriname to fight escaped slaves who'd run away into the jungle and formed rebel cells there and kind of emerged periodically to burn down plantation homes. So when I read it, I was like, this is really perfect for I'm a Miracle, because I think it talks about the legacy of colonialism that is still kind of refracted, or that we hear or feel kind of echoes on in the present, the idea that there are still dynamics that were created centuries ago that still exist today in a bit of kind of morphed or shifted, but can still kind of be felt, and the discrepancies in kind of justice that were created at that point in history still reverberate today. So, I kind of read this story, and it's also a really good story, too. Yeah. It's just about these Dutch colonists who ended up in the jungle of Suriname, who didn't even know how to fire their guns, or had just been really recruited off the streets and thrown into Suriname.
Which I'm sure would have happened a lot back then.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
So, Matt, all of a sudden you have this play that's sitting in front of you, then directing it. It's three separate stories and played out in three separate arenas.
Yeah, I think this is something that Declan often does in his writing, is sort of set lots of very different worlds in one play. And the sort of, I think, the challenge of a director and everyone working on it is how to weave it all together, how to create sort of a coherent theatrical world for it, but at the same time acknowledge that it has to be really contradictory and sort of really playful in that. So this production is sort of, we almost like create a theatrical machine. There's sort of a space that is like a giant cell in many ways, and it sort of has, I don't want to give away all the big sort
of course,
big visual spectacles moments of it, but it's, the first part is a monologue, so it's really about listening very, very carefully to
an
actor.
It's performed by Melita Jurasic, who's probably one of the great stage actors in Australia.
It's a tour de force for Melita, where it's half an hour with her conjuring just with words, essentially, this graphic story,
in the jungle and going on a suicide mission.
But then we have to jump into this sort of almost filmic, like, naturalism on stage of this relationship and playing out in Melbourne. And so we sort of create a new sort of theatrical machine to do that. And then we have another sort of theatrical machine that creates a miracle at the end of the show. Or we try to create a miracle.
Right. Oh, gosh. I want to be there when the miracle happens. Wow. There's so much, my head's spinning with all the, you guys obviously know it backwards now, but for me, and I'm sure Brendan, you'd be thinking the same way, is that you just got to see it to pull all this together and see how you've done it all in one night.
We only saw it last night for the audience for the first time, so it's a constantly evolving work, really. But it is, I think it's a work that has a lot of scope to it. Like, I think it's got big ideas that Declan's been talking about, but it has a real range of theatricality. And I think that's something that, a lot of Malthouse shows really aim to do, that it's sort of saying there's no one type of theatre, and it's a theatre that's constantly looking at how can it speak to us, what different forms can it use, how can it be subversive and unpredictable.
Yeah, fantastic. So it's on at Malthouse now. It started last night and until August 9. And obviously just go to Malthouse for bookings.
Yep.
Okay. Malthousetheatre.com.au.
Thank you so much for coming in, and thanks for getting my interest up. There's a bird making a noise outside the studio.
It's the most bizarre
thing. Oh, it just flew away, thank God. Thank you so much for coming in. And
thanks for having us, guys.
Our pleasure.
You're on Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9.
extremely talented Amy Winehouse here on Joy 94.9 on Sunday Arts Magazine. It's halfway through our show already, David.
Yes.
It always gets out of hand, doesn't it? Now, we did get a couple of messages in. One was about Bowie from the lovely Florence, mm-hmm. who actually let us know that Bowie had a house in Sydney.
I never knew that yes. he lived in Sydney. Well, probably didn't live there, but had a house. Probably. Back in the day, a lot of those... the big artists like Elton John, well, he got married here. And there was a suite at the Siebel Townhouse in Sydney were named after him, and you know, he was there more than he wasn't. And what they used to do is that they used to have private jets that would fly them to Adelaide or to Melbourne, and they'd fly back each night to stay in their hotel. They wouldn't stay in a different hotel in different cities. So that's, yeah. The old days. The good old
Love
days.
Your little music stories, David. Florence also said, very apt, that Mr. Obama just visited prisons as the first president in history to do so, talking about I Am a Miracle. Mm. So that's, yeah, history is somewhat changing with that, but there's a long way to go.
Yeah, and everything he does, he seems to get crucified by so many people over there. But I think, yeah, history will show that he has been doing some great things.
Now
talking about history.
History and important stories.
Oh, you just got to mention about...
We'll come back to Amy. We'll talk about the documentary. I did get to go see that. But we can't leave this any longer. We've got to talk to this gentleman. Steve Thomas, director of Freedom Stories. Very excited to talk to Steve about this. Welcome, firstly. Oh, sorry, I might turn your mic on. thank you for coming in. It's a very important documentary, and we will talk about that in just a moment. But I want to talk about your history as a director, or you know, your history in film. You know, how did you get your start? How did you get a leg up in film to begin with?
I didn't really start until I came to Australia from England back in 1981. And before that, I was a youth worker, I was a school teacher, I was a civil servant. But, you know, it's interesting, when you change countries, you can change your identity. No one really knows what you've been up to. And I went along to Open Channel, actually, and did some courses in filmmaking. I was sort of interested in documentary as education, I guess. But nowadays I'm more interested in it for its own sake, as a kind of art form, really.
Because it's a tough world, isn't it? Getting the finances, getting it shown. There's a lot of things you've got to do, isn't there, to actually get the project up?
It is a tough world, particularly if you want to earn your living that way. I don't have to do that because I teach filmmaking at the VCA.
Oh, so good on you.
I kind of have a dual career.
Right.
But about every 4 or 5 years, I managed to churn out a film, and this one took 4 years. And a lot of that time was trying to raise money, primarily through philanthropy in this case.
Yeah. And so therefore, you know, you would have people helping you write the grants or find the right people to help you, or do you do it all yourself?
In doco, it's a kind of self-help industry, really. But I've had producer Lisa Horler. Between the two of us, we've done probably several, up to 100 applications in the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, we managed to raise enough money through philanthropy. People are concerned about the asylum seeker issue, and particularly when we said that we want to paint a different picture to the general one that people get of asylum seekers.
Right. Well, let's move into it now, because you mentioned what it's about. What's it called?
It's called Freedom Stories.
Right.
It was going to be called 10 Years On, because I was kind of interested in what happened to all those people that came in 2001, you know, the year of the Tampa and Children Overboard and all
yep.
of that.
Yep.
And I'd been wondering, I wonder what happened to all those people who were in the news headlines burning down the Woomera Detention Centre. That was back in 2011. Which was 10 years on, but it took 4 years to make the film, so we couldn't keep calling it 10 years on. It would have had to have been 14 years on. So we changed it to Freedom.
Right. And, but the thing is that with that extra 4 years you had, the stories would have unfolded a little bit more, wouldn't they?
It's really good in a way to have a long gestation period, because it gives you the opportunity to develop relationships, which are really important when you're making a film like this. I mean, people in the film are exposing their vulnerabilities, some sad stories, although I think it's an uplifting film.
Oh, and definitely from what I've seen of it, it's very uplifting.
But you need solid, trusting relationships to work your way through that in the filmmaking process.
Yeah. And how was it talking with them? Did a lot of them turn you down and said, no, I don't want this exposure, or I'm too shy to do it?
Yeah, there were kind of three kinds of groups. There were those that didn't want to talk any more about that.
Yep.
You know, I'm fed up of being
They're getting on with their lives.
I don't want to be a refugee anymore.
Yep.
And then there were those who were kind of so damaged by the experience that they couldn't talk about it.
Right.
And in between was a third group who not only felt able to talk about it, but I think felt that they ought to talk about it because they want Australians to understand the human story behind the controversies, you know.
Do you think it helped them to sort of, I guess, challenge some of their demons as well by actually getting that out?
I think it did. There are moments in the film where people are talking about things that happened in detention or after detention that clearly they haven't really talked about in public before. And interestingly, Arif, who's a builder, you know, I showed the film to his family afterwards and they all watched it. And then he turned to me and he said, do you know, even my own family don't know some of this stuff. And he said, it's important that they should know it, but they never ask me and I never tell them.
Yeah, exactly. But what I also loved about it was the fact that there's a lot of feel-good little situations. Like there's this one guy who's an artist and it's wonderful to see his art and how proud he was, you know, showing his art. And then a great little snippet with a Tyler that worked on Molly Meldrum's swimming pool, which everyone knows his house and the whole Egyptian thing that he has. And what a joy there and how wonderful he would have been to this guy that was working at his place.
Yeah, it was hilarious, really, because that was Arif, who I just mentioned. And, of course, he arrived from Afghanistan. He didn't know Molly Meldrum from anybody else.
Yes.
So he was quite surprised to find he was a celebrity. But certainly...
And how colourful as well. We're working around that house, he would have been sort of thinking, what all I've got myself into?
Well, he come from Woomera, the detention centre in a town full of rockets and weapons on every street corner, and turning up at Molly's house, it must have been a surreal experience, really.
And so he hadn't told his family about them, Molly? They did know about that.
No, they did know about that, but some of his experience prior to managing to recreate his life in Australia.
Yeah. Now, it's shown at the Sydney Film Festival, and now it's down here in Melbourne. Do you do the world circuit with it?
Well, that remains to be seen. I'm keen to do the Australian circuit with it. One of the great things for a filmmaker is to sit down with an audience, screen your film, and then have a vigorous Q&A. Debate
yep.
afterwards.
Yep.
And that's what we're going to do at the Nova for the first two sessions on Thursday and Friday nights.
Uh-huh.
So that'll be terrific. We hope that other cinemas around Australia will pick it up, even in small kind of seasons. And then we really want to travel with the film around the regions and some of the areas where perhaps there's more suspicion of asylum seekers than in the big cities.
Yeah. But because there can be that feeling, isn't there, at times, you know, well, who are they? And, you know, and the governments, especially at present, there is all this, we don't want them, we're turning them back. But a lot of them were desperate people getting away from desperate situations, weren't they?
Well, it's a cliche to say so, but they're also the kind of people we need here because they've got resilience.
Yes.
And they've got, you know,
a lot of skills.
Skills and enthusiasm for their new country as migrants traditionally have when they've come here.
Yes.
And that's something that impressed me greatly. I mean, I don't want to idealise them. And there's a sense in which they feel they have to prove themselves because of those negative stereotypes.
Yeah.
But it certainly motivates them.
Yeah. Is it something that you do want the world to see, though? You know, would you like it out there?
Sure, absolutely. And we'll be doing our best. We're already entering the film in overseas festivals and so on, following its screening at Sydney. But I found with my previous film that touched on similar issues that every country has their refugee issues and they're not always keen to be reminded that everyone else has issues too. It all becomes a bit difficult.
But nice to be able to see different countries' viewpoint on it.
It is. And I mean, I've done that as I've travelled with other films and, you know, it makes you realise we talk about, you know, we can't have refugees flooding into this country. There's no flood here. You know, go to Europe, you'll find a flood.
Oh, well, Greece even right this very moment, of all places for them to be landing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I feel we've become over the years immune to this issue and a little bit mean-spirited, to say the least. And this film just wants to I would just want to remind people, hang on, you know, these people are human beings. They've got ambitions and dreams just like you and I.
Yeah.
They're not that different.
No, absolutely. Well, thank you for one for making this film, because it is a very important story that needs to be told and documented. And two, that it's great that you're teaching film as well, because the new generation's coming through. Because it's a hard game, isn't it? As we were saying earlier, getting the funding and all that. It's a hard world film.
It's a hard game, but like the arts in general, you know, you do it out of love at the end of the day.
Yeah. So it's at Nova, Cinema Nova, and you've got the Q&As. On what nights are they next week?
Next Thursday and Friday, 23rd and 24th.
Right.
And then it's screening for the rest of the film week, which runs from Thursdays to Wednesdays.
Right. And, of course, if you go just onto Cinema Nova's website, you'll find out all the details.
All the details, special guests, David Mann, and, you know, all kinds of people coming along.
Oh, excellent.
Plus filmmakers, plus participants from the film.
Oh, wonderful.
Shafiq the artist.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, so it should be fun.
Excellent. That sounds great.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
You're on Joy 94.9. It is Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy.
One of my favourite singers. That was Lana Del Rey and her version of Blue Velvet here on Sunday Arts Magazine.
Beautiful version of it.
Oh, yes, well. I try and slip that one in every once in a while,
yeah,
because it is one of my favourite tracks.
Beautiful,
of hers.
Beautiful track.
Yes. Now, you are listening to Joy 94.9, and we've got another interview. We've squeezed three in today, David.
We have, because there's so much going on in this wonderful city of ours.
Too much. We love it. So, welcome writer, director, composer, probably other things as well, Natasha. I'll get you on the mic again.
Hello.
It's one of those days today. Thank you for coming in, firstly.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you do have so many strings in your bow. How did that come about? Can you go into a little bit of your history of how you came to be where you are today?
Well, I've been creating music for theatre for many years, and then about 6 or 7 years ago, I started to write soundtracks for film, short films.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
Short films, mostly for friends.
So did you study music?
Yes, I did, a long time ago in Adelaide, where I grew up.
Oh, we might know each other. I'm originally from Adelaide.
Well, you know what, David, they say you can take the girl out of Adelaide, but you can't take the Adelaide out of the girl.
I say exact same thing to David.
So I did music for theatre for a long time, and then I created quite a few shows in Melbourne in the last sort of 10-15 years that were body percussion, which is using the body as a musical instrument.
Uh-huh.
And after that, I had a kind of a difficult time in my life, and I was not sleeping. I mean, I have had insomnia since I was a teenager, actually. But some years ago, I thought, okay, I have tried so many strategies to deal with it. I will make art out of it. And I realized that I had to write the texts, write the music, set the scenario, and that's why I came to do all those many things that I'm doing on this project now.
What's it called?
The Insomnia Project.
Right, and obviously it's about is it your journey?
No, it's based on true experiences, but it involves four disparate characters. They don't know each other, and they never interact on stage. The reason for this is that I feel insomnia is a very isolating experience.
And very personal, isn't
exactly.
it? Yes.
So they may be all on stage together, but they're linked by this condition, but they never speak to each other and they never interact. As you would probably guess, if you can't sleep, you can't ring people up all the time and share the experience. You're sort of in it by yourself.
Yeah, and it's that whole thing about whether, you know, in the middle of the night, your mind plays these. If I wake up in the middle of the night and I try to tell myself it's that time of day, you
yes.
know, like, and there must be some thought pattern behind it, which I'm sure you know, but I really have to talk myself out of it, and my mind still goes crazy. Even though I'm saying to myself, don't let this get to you, don't let it get to you, you'll wake up in the morning and it will be fine, it wasn't that big of a drama.
Yes, well, the dramatic structure of the show follows the four characters over one sleepless night from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. and the audience gets to know what time it is. As the night wears on, they get more angsty, more frustrated, more exhausted and much more anxious, so the mood changes, the music changes, and we watch them slowly going a bit berserk. It's quite intense, really.
Right. And why did you feel you had to do it all? Because it was such a personal experience that you needed to write the story, then direct it because you knew it so well, and because of your music background, composed the music. And you've written songs for this as well.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I felt I needed to be entirely responsible for this story. And I produced it myself last year as well. We did an initial short season at Gallery 314 in Richmond. And then this time round, we're doing it at La Mama Courthouse.
Uh-huh. And, you know, the songs, what are the songs about? That angst in the middle of the night? Or is it just people just sort of daydreaming at that time of night?
Well, for example, at 10 o'clock at night, when we go to bed, we're still feeling fairly positive and, you know, our mood is fairly good. So the songs at 10 o'clock are more about fantasizing about a loved one or happy times and so on. But as it gets later and later,
of course,
the songs start to be about childhood experiences, memory, and things like that.
Something that happened at work yesterday.
Possibly, yes.
Right.
Yes.
And what was the audience's reaction to it?
Last year's production was very well received, and it was very gratifying to hear the responses. People said they had no idea what kind of a journey an insomniac actually has when they go to bed.
Right. And it would also be a case of that people that suffer with it as well coming to see it and thinking to themselves, oh, I'm not alone.
That's exactly right. In fact, apparently one in three Australians suffer from some sort of sleep disorder.
Right.
That's a pretty high percentage, really. Yeah.
And with everything, and especially within the arts, it's nice to experience it. So if you don't suffer from it, you know, because I know some people that, my best friend that I grew up with back in Adelaide, who he can sleep anywhere, and he goes to sleep at night and wakes up the next morning. You know, no matter what time he goes, sleep in early or late, he'll still sleep all through the night and then just wake up in the morning. And he has no real comprehension on that being awake in the middle of the night.
Yes. Well, often insomniacs are paired up with people who sleep well, so you get this kind of imbalance. And one of the pieces in the show is a poem that one of the characters delivers where she says, "I hate anything that sleeps." Because you get to that point.
Yep.
You start to resent people who can sleep because you think, why is my body not functioning like it should?
Yeah.
I can definitely vouch for that.
Yeah?
Because, yeah, I think that's two in three in this room alone. But I want to know, you wrote this, you know, for catharsis, I guess.
In
a little way. How has it helped you?
Well, I should just take a step back here. I also meditate every day. And what meditation has given me is a way of accepting this condition and being more at peace with it than I used to be. It hasn't made me sleep better, but I have more strategies now to deal with it. And as for writing the show, I now feel that insomnia and I are very, very close friends.
Frenemies.
Maybe. Exactly. Yeah.
So it would have to help you, surely,
yes,
you
know, like, yes.
with your problem. Well, because that's what it's all about, isn't it? With me saying when the odd times it happens to me, I try to talk myself out of it. And it's only my weak mind that doesn't, where the meditation would help a lot.
Yes. But sometimes, as you probably know, it's a nanosecond between feeling relatively okay and then spiraling down into that rumination where everything gets magnified and everything seems dark and the monsters are there. So there's songs about that too.
Oh, okay. Fantastic. Well, it sounds fascinating, and it's something that I feel that we all should see, sufferers or not, because just have an understanding for people that might, your partner that might be suffering from it, but you sleep all night, and a third person telling a story on it would be good. So it's showing from the 29th. To the 9th of August at La Mama
Courthouse.
The courthouse. And obviously, you just go onto their website.
That's
to book tickets. Thank you so much for coming in today. And good luck with the sleeping in the future.
Thank you.
Try to beat it.
Joy 94.9, it is Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy.
You keep me hanging on, David.
Oh, I certainly do, Brendan.
Well, I am having a perfect day with you. Aww, it's always lovely to likewise. Come in and do Sunday Arts with you. We do have a lot of fun.
And such great people that we talk to every week. The arts is just a fascinating place. And what I love about it, it's political, what people put into art, like the doco.
Yep.
Sleep Pattern is now a play. It's just wonderful. And then the first interview today was about sort of people that...
Well, it's also political, I
feel. Yeah, very political. It's fascinating. But you saw a doco. You actually mentioned...
Yes, so I did play Amy Winehouse a little earlier. Yep. And I kind of left the film kind of angry and sad at the same time. Right. Just,
why is that?
The men in her life just completely failed her.
Oh, do they? You know, the husband was a real loser, wasn't he?
Complete loser.
But wasn't her father wonderful, but she just pushed him away a bit? No? Because he seems to be doing
a good thing now. Well, he's done a lot now, but he came out of it looking pretty shoddy as well. Just because he was kind of... He was riding the Amy train as well by the time he sort of came back into her life and she was hitting the charts and, you know, he was making money off her essentially. Mm. And he does seem like not a terrible guy, but I think he was just a bit of an opportunist and kind of thought, oh, well, she'll be fine. She'll be fine. Well, you know.
How often do you hear that with fathers when they're not around sometimes?
And what I didn't realize was Rehab was written directly from her life. It was, you know, my daddy says, I'm fine. Yeah. I'm not going to go.
Right.
It was. He said, no, you're fine, Amy. Let's just keep going. You'll be fine.
Okay.
So that kind of threw me off. It was incredible to know that was really just ripped from her real life. So.
And it's good that this doco has come out about her because she... A great talent and so sad as well.
So sad. Yeah, I recommend just going back to the music and letting that live on.
Yep, exactly.
Now, that is enough for Sunday Arts Magazine, but we will be back with another show next week. I'm going to be really tired because I'm doing the age run. So, but stick around for the news with Bassam here on Joy 94.9. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Brendan.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.